My 20s were a pretty big struggle. I had a lot of friends who I think had a little more sort of maybe a little more guardrails from their parents or just sense of where they were going. And so they got jobs or went to graduate school. You know, some of them got promotions and bonuses. And I kind of was hopping from thing to thing, desperate to find some kind of traction and sense of what my sort of purpose was.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. How do you find your idea? The idea that you can build into something great. The idea that nobody else had, or at least nobody really understood as well as you. It's the kind of thing people spend their lives searching for. They want that big idea, and it doesn't always come easy, as Jake Schwartz knows well. When he graduated from Yale University, he felt lost. His friends had gone on to land big jobs, but he felt like something was missing. He was on a search for something, but didn't exactly know what. So he pursued ideas for companies and co-working and crowdfunding, but nothing really stuck. And then he had the idea. It was to innovate inside the education space and build a company that today is known around the world. It's called General Assembly. But of course, that skips over a lot of steps, including the many, many failures that Jake experienced as he built General Assembly into the education giant it is today. It sold to the HR mega company, Adecco Group, in 2018 for a reported $413 million. And Jake, he is still part of the company today. So I wanted to sit down with Jake and understand that journey of his, from a guy who felt lost to a guy who finally found his idea, and then a guy who had to figure out how to really make that idea work. This is the very core of entrepreneurship. It starts with an insight, an idea, and we'll hear how Jake found his after the break. There's a reason why active investors will often put their money into property. It can be a really strong investment with returns that beat the market. But of course, the average person in the past couldn't actually become an investor and part owner in real estate because of very strict rules about who is and isn't an accredited investor. But that has now changed. You can now co-own apartment complexes with investment minimums starting under $1,000 when you invest with DiversiFund. The investment process only takes 10 minutes. DiversiFund manages real estate deals from start to finish, cutting out the middlemen typically involved in the process, which allows them to cut all the platform and management fees commonly charged to investors, meaning you could get an even higher return. When you invest in commercial real estate, you're diversifying your portfolio and guarding against the volatility of the stock market. So take a look at what DiversiFund has to offer and how they can get you in on the action. Visit diversifund.com/entrepreneur. That's diversifund.com/entrepreneur. And now, on with the show. Okay, we're back. So a quick word about timing before you hear our conversation. We actually taped this podcast many months ago, long before WeWork's failed IPO and its ongoing downfall. But as you'll hear, Jake saw that coming. I think it's fair to say that this is an important skill, the ability to see something coming. It's what finally led Jake to his aha moment. But let's start a little earlier than that. I asked Jake to take me through his quest for a big idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've talked about this before. So I grew up in Oregon, which, you know, is pretty far away from New York City.
Yeah, as far as you can go, I think, right?
And when I remember very distinctly getting into my first choice college, which was Yale. And at the time, it lived in my imagination as, well, I've made it. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm done.
That's what you've worked all those 18 years,
exactly.
Right? So you could tell everyone you went to Yale.
It's like a ticket punch,
yes.
Right? And I figured I had some magical passport to the world. And that's even more reinforced, you know, when you graduate the diploma, this is sort of how, you know, fancy of a school it is. Yeah. It's all in Latin.
Oh, right. So no normal guy like me or anyone probably can ever read
it.
I took Latin in high school, but I don't remember.
But I kind of think that's on purpose.
Sure.
It's a bit of a, it's like a Harry Potter spell, yeah. Right? And I think I thought, like a Harry Potter spell, that it would just kind of open any door that I wanted by, I guess, chanting it aloud.
Sure.
Or anything like that. And then, of course, you know, I got out into the real world and found that I hadn't learned any real skills. I was a humanities major.
Right.
Really, I could bullshit my way through any course, pretend I did the reading.
Sure.
You know, I mean, as many people do. But I didn't really know how to do anything. I didn't really understand how the world worked at all. And that meant my 20s were a pretty big struggle. You know, I had a lot of friends who I think had a little more sort of maybe a little more guardrails from their parents.
Sure.
Or just sense of where they were going. And so they got jobs or went to graduate school. You know, some of them got promotions and bonuses. And I kind of was hopping from thing to thing, desperate to find some kind of traction and sense of what my sort of purpose was.
Right.
And, you know, I eventually kind of hustled my way into financial services. I was in investment management for a while.
So you're coming out, right? You graduate.
Yeah.
Friends are getting jobs at big investment banks. They have kind of an idea, you know, I'm going to be this finance guy. But you're at this stage, you just went to Yale, the best school in the country. You come out, and what are you feeling at that time, like before you took that job? Are you was that a...
Oh, it's probably that really deep existential terror. And at least for me, you know,
sure.
My parents were on the other side of the country. They didn't know anybody in New York to help me navigate this.
Yeah.
I didn't really know how to do anything. So you kind of feel like, oh, I'm already a failure.
Right.
I just got out of the gate and it's over.
Right.
Right?
These kids have, other classmates have jobs ready
exactly.
to go at Goldman
exactly.
Sachs and wherever, and they know what they want.
You know, they're wearing suits every day to work. It seems important. They get an expense account when they travel.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here like, oh, crap, how do I pay my rent?
Right.
Right? And, I mean, it was a real struggle. It's very, very lonely. I talk a lot
totally.
To my team about that feeling of being lost and lonely in the world of work. And now I can look back and say, I can look at so many people, I think, share that experience.
Oh, yeah.
Even the ones that seem like they have it all figured out.
Yeah.
And so for me, like that struggle, that way of hustling from thing to thing, hopping around, kind of having to make it up as I was going, at the time was incredibly painful, made me feel like I was failing. But eventually, you know, I kind of cobbled together. I had some day jobs that I kind of faked my way into.
Right.
I started a couple things at night, sort of more entrepreneurial things and tried to sort of build this weird hodgepodge story. I eventually went back to business school just to kind of try to put it all together. But I think about that experience, and I think when I look at GA and what GA really was founded to be, which was this place for people to come and learn in the context of doing with a community of people where it was okay to be a different spot on that journey. You didn't have to pretend to have it all figured out on day one.
And did that idea, did that come from you and I guess co-founders? And I relate to this 1,000% because I had that same loneliness and not sure what I was going to do. But does that feeling or did GA come from, hey, I just went to Yale, I'm out, and I really didn't learn much that is helping me right now start my career and set myself
up? I think it's a big part of it. I think we're sort of in transition of two types of worlds. One was if you go to the right school and you have the right credential, it doesn't really matter what you know how to do.
That's right.
Because you're going to learn everything all over again on the job. And your job is to show yourself as an upstanding young man or something like that you get a spot.
Yeah.
You know, you're at the bottom and you work your way up.
Yeah.
That's sort of this conception, you know, and it's almost, you know, you can almost think of those early years as hazing to get that seat at the table.
You're finally there. It's like probably started, I would imagine, back in the 40s and 50s, and it lasted a long, long time.
Well,
and
changed. We've also had this huge economic expansion.
Right.
Where there was always another seat available eventually for you to take.
Right.
I think what's changed, or what seems to have been changing, is that employers are much more critical and thoughtful of who are even those first seats going to, and what can you do immediately to drive value for your employer.
Right.
Right. And even that concept of driving value is not something a 22-year-old is really thinking about. They're
right.
I'm told I'm supposed to go get a job. They're going to pay me money.
Right.
I got to pretend to be a more grown up than I actually
am. So true.
It's this whole kind of weird dance and game that some people sort of are more comfortable with than others. But what's happening more and more is it's about what can you do. Now, there are actually parts of our economy that were always about
what can you do. Right.
They typically were just what we call blue collar.
Exactly.
And I think the real thesis was that this idea of doing outside of very specific parts of the white collar world is a new concept.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, oh, wow, I can, if I can know how to write this code, or I know how to how to run these processes, or I can describe how I would analyze this data set. That's all you need to know to get the job. It doesn't matter what you're wearing.
And high-paying jobs as opposed to, let's say, years ago with blue-collar jobs and really setting yourself up. So at this time then, when you're looking at it and you realize, wait, what happened? So you're at this investment company and you're thinking...
Well, you went to business school. Yeah, so
after.
I went to business school. I was going to start a crowdfunding business, believe it or not. This is 2007.
Like a Kickstarter kind?
It was before Kickstarter. Because I had done some investment management,
gotcha.
I kind of could see the writing on the wall. I graduated in 2008 from business school. Could see that things were not looking so great out there in the world.
Right, yeah.
It had already turned. Now, Lehman hadn't totally
gone under yet,
but it was people were already talking about bad things happening. And so I kind of had this moment of saying, I probably shouldn't just go out on my own in this moment. And I was fortunate I had done a lot of extracurricular work at business school working with, and one of them was with an investment fund and they offered me a job.
Sure.
I figured, great, safe harbor for the next
little stage.
Now, I didn't know how bad the financial crisis was going to get.
Sure.
And so it was a seat, it was safety, but like almost every investment vehicle during that time, our hands were tied. There wasn't much to do.
Yeah.
So I spent 2 years kind of like trying to help these failing entrepreneurs in the portfolio company, looking at these amazing deals that we couldn't pull the trigger on, and sort of slowly felt myself kind of withering away, right?
Sure, yeah.
And I actually think that if you think about that first phase after college is this moment of really informing that pain, that lost sense of myself that led to this inspiration for what could we be done different.
Right.
That was that moment after business school of saying, oh, I'm just going to be an entrepreneur.
Right.
And where it really came from is I said, I don't want to be dependent on anyone else for my own future anymore.
Sure.
And really the key point was deciding that I didn't care if it meant I was going to make a quarter of what my business school classmates were making.
Yeah.
I didn't care if it meant that I couldn't afford going to a club and buying bottles or something crazy like that.
But
like,
I think you're
that they were doing.
That's the hardest situation.
And it was crazy.
Yes.
It was scary. And it had to push me to this point of real existential crisis to do it. But that minute I made that switch and started trusting my own instincts and just deciding that there was no safe place for me other than the one I created for myself was when things really started to change. And they didn't change overnight. And there was still a journey on the way, but it was almost like I had girded myself with just a decision that allowed me to go out and make the best of what I could see around me, as opposed to always hoping that someone else could solve my problems on my behalf.
Exactly. And I think that's about what being an entrepreneur is coming up with that moment where you realize the only way you're going to live the life you want to or do the things you want to is if you put out your own shingle. And it sounds like at that time, you were able to make that decision. And once you made that decision and came up with this, did you go on that road and never question yourself
I don't think I questioned it for a while, because what I found was the minute I started to put myself out there, and at the time I was just literally trying to pay my rent, right?
Sure.
And I started kind of hustling and pretending to be a consultant, and I would go to people I knew who had sort of growth stage companies or even later stage companies and said, hey, I noticed you guys aren't doing this. I did a project in business school on this. Let me do this for you. And you only have to pay me a few $1,000s a month and I'll do it for you. And so I was just kind of like cobbling together. But one of the key things was I always left a day of the week for stuff that I owned. It was my thing.
So 4 days you're focusing on this consulting.
Yeah, I would sell a day of the week to another company. And then that last day was always mine. And that allowed me to sort of follow creativity. And so I was actually kind of happy. I was flowing. It was actually working.
You're getting clients.
Wasn't dipping into my savings or anything like that.
Right.
It was amazing. It was a
miracle. You're paying the rent.
Right. Now, it wasn't scalable. It probably wasn't even sustainable. But it did say, okay, that first scary leap, I didn't die.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Now,
you're not living on the streets. You're still here. You're paying your rent. And you've got people who are trusting in you and hiring you.
That's right. And so that really led to being in a position, several positions actually, to see opportunities and create things that were, at the start, just stories, right? Stories about myself. Who am I? What am I doing? And it allowed me to create them for myself. And then they started to, it was almost like, it wasn't the first one, but you know, if you think of your life and your time like a portfolio, I had enough of a portfolio that one or two started to work. And one of those was this idea of a co-working space, right? Which was not a great idea. I mean, I guess.
But how do you look at, so okay, it's amazing. Like you had the Kickstarter idea, billion-dollar business. When you started this co-working, like WeWork was probably just starting. I don't even know if they, like you've been on to a couple like, disrupting major businesses. But what, so take me to that moment.
Well, the way I tend to think about this, and WeWork's a whole other conversation, honestly. But at the end of the day, what I believe is when you see a moment in time opportunity, when you do the work to put together an opportunity, you think about the trends, but it's not just about trends. It's like, does this work today? Why does this work? What's driving customers to change the way they're spending their money? Or, you know, all of those kinds of dynamics. When you find an opportunity that works, that has the coherent story around it, what I now sort of believe is those things, those are the good ideas.
Sure.
Nobody ever really has an idea that starts at the very, very high level, they go out there in the world and it just magically works.
Right.
I mean, maybe that's not true. Maybe somebody does.
Very few, though.
That's like winning
stuff.
The lottery, right? Because they got really lucky.
It's a great idea. It's, yes, exactly.
It really has to be grounded in what the day-to-day is. And like, oh, this works. This is the value proposition. This is why this adds value to the existing environment. And then what you hope is if it works, okay, great. Now can I do it 100 more times?
Exactly.
Now, with co-working, I had just been through the 2008. I'd seen what happens when you take on risk. And the reality was signing this lease for the first space that is now our headquarters, there was a lot of risk involved.
Yeah,
and
absolutely. Because you have to sign,
and frankly,
don't you have to sign a multi-year deal? And like
10-year deal.
You have to guarantee it
good
yourself.
Good guy guarantee,
right.
All that. And then I started thinking about, okay, well, let's say we multiplied that times 100 times.
Right.
And I thought about, well, that's, I would get 100 times the revenue, but I would also be taking 100 times the risk.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like anything where your revenue is tied basically linearly to how much risk you're taking, how much liability or debt you could also call it, you're taking doesn't seem like a very promising idea in the long term.
Right.
Now, I think what I didn't bet on was we're going to have the largest expansion in history and that venture capital and equity investors were going to be desperate to find things that would provide return, and we're not going to be terribly critical about looking at balance sheets and, and maybe off balance sheet liabilities.
Yeah.
I might have said, well, this is great. This is an easy way to get some revenue. Let's just do this until it breaks, which I think is kind of what WeWork did. Now, we haven't seen it break yet,
right.
But I think the jury is still out on that. We
have idea. You're exactly right. And I think just looking at it, the jury is still out with WeWork. With you guys, though, and going back to that, those first moments.
Let's think of all the different pieces, right? So we had this space. We had this one room that we decided to call a classroom.
Is this this building right here? This is the original. Okay.
Yeah. And we had this one room and we didn't know what to call it. So we call it a classroom. And we had this thing of, wouldn't it be a fun thing for the community if we could run classes out of it? And it's this idea of learning by doing. So we have all these startups here. What if they could teach each other? Isn't that like a utopian idea of a community?
Right. So you have a co-working space with people doing different businesses. Mm-hmm. And then the thought was more of a kind of everyone being able to share their expertise and learn from each other.
100%. Now, what's really funny about that idea is that didn't work at all. Because it turned out startups
but
don't...
that's how it happens.
Startups
right?
don't have time right. to take classes. They're like right. going... they're like just trying
you're
to survive.
Right. You're right. That's a great...
But what was really interesting is that the general public was super interested in these classes. And so we started selling out night after night. And it was like little, you know, you see the room is about 30 people can fit in there. And it was anything that anyone wanted to teach. We were very, very... sort of liberal.
Any skill.
But it wasn't even a skill. I think one of the first classes that was ever taught there was the history of the internet.
That's great.
which is such a cool, and I actually learned stuff. It was neat. Some of it was, you know, how to raise money, how to put a Twitter API on your website. Yeah. It sort of dates it a little bit.
Well, it reminds me of, and I don't know, you're probably maybe too young, but like there was this learning annex back in the day. Like I'm going back 20, 30 years. It was all different. Like this seems like it wasn't focused yet at the time on specifically kind of business.
But that I tended to, because of my background, and I got involved in the arts, and one of those nighttime things I started was a sort of a weird community art center on 42nd Street. And so I said, well, this is interesting because there's energy there. There's enthusiasm for it. We're selling out a lot. That's a data point. The problem is if I look at this business model as it stands today, which is fill up 30 seats in a room every night with a different thing, I was like, that sounds like the worst off-Broadway theater on the history of the planet.
You know what? That's a great point. You're right.
And so
it's hard to scale.
I really then had to step back. And that was really the moment where I thought about my own experience in my 20s. I looked a lot at education. I read a really influential book by a friend of mine, Anya Kamenetz, called DIYU, about really all these exciting macro changes in the world of education.
Why was it so influential for you?
Well, because I knew her. I knew how deeply researched it was and how thoughtful she was. And it really gave this landscape. And actually the most, I'll get to why it was so influential, because it really, that combined with watching where the energy was, this was sort of the era of MOOCs, right? Mm-hmm. This concept that online education is going to change everything. And when I looked at the business, I said, why is everybody so interested in education as an industry? I get why people are passionate about it. We all have great experiences, but why is it an industry? And when I looked at it, I said, what's really interesting about education is for most people, it is either the number one, number two, or number three largest check they ever write in their life.
That's a great point.
And I asked myself, why is that? And this is where my background also sort of played in. I said, it's not because it's not like 1,000 times more valuable than the time you spend in a movie theater or in a play. It's because it's not really about the content or the experience of being in a classroom that people are paying for. It's an investment in their future.
Right.
And so you put it up front just like a house, right? You put a bunch of money, you're writing a check basically on faith, because you believe that over time you will get a return on that. It will pay for itself.
Yeah, it's an investment.
That was also what they said about business school, by the way.
Yeah, we'll get to that point if
so,
that was actually
when I read
it.
DIYU, what was so interesting is so many of the innovations that people were talking about were really along the lens of, okay, what Spotify did to music or what Netflix did to TV and movies. This was sort of the paradigm that everybody was caught in. And I said, it's interesting that everyone treats it like a content business, whereas as far as I can tell, what makes the industry so big in terms of dollars, what makes it so interesting has nothing to do with content. It has to do with everything else.
Right.
And content just happens to be one piece of it. But really, it's about investment and return. And that was really the paradigm shift. As I said, what we have to do is change this from I'll go for one night and learn a few things and enjoy myself and meet some people, to I am going to be investing in myself with real time and real money, and I'm going to get some kind of return out of that changes my life.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors. How Success Happens. It's the name of this podcast. But it also describes the process of starting a business with the goal of helping people live happier, healthier lives. I'm talking about MindBody. For almost 20 years, they've been linking hundreds of thousands of passionate health, wellness, and beauty professionals to the millions of clients they serve. MindBody understands that taking care of yourself means something different for everyone. And that's why they're committed to connecting millions of customers to a huge selection of local fitness classes, massage and acupuncture, salons and spas, and they find, book, and pay all in one app. You can partner with them by listing your business at mindbodyonline.com/success. MindBody, the solution to grow and manage every detail of your business and customer experience. mindbodyonline.com/success. And our next sponsor. I'm usually not open to trying new types of dress shirts, especially ones with many colors or a little different from my normal look. But my wife, she's the stylist in our family, and she ends up buying me new shirts. I usually hesitate, of course, to wear them, but then I wear them, I start getting compliments, and I want more. Well, the same thing happened when I tried on Paul Frederick shirts. They had interesting colors and really cool patterns that totally elevated my wardrobe. Paul Frederick has been making dress shirts for over 30 years, And those shirts are pretty darn good. The Paul Frederick shirts I have feel good. They're comfortable. I even tried a purple shirt on for the first time. And you know what? Adding some color to my look lifted my spirits and people noticed. And of course, people noticed my shirt as I got compliments on it when I walked down the street. So of course, I went back to Paul Frederick and bought more shirts. And now you can get $50 off any shirt from Paul Frederick just by visiting paulfrederick.com/HSH. Again, that's paulfrederick.com/HSH.
And we're back. So at that time, you're thinking, okay, you're reminding yourself just a few years earlier and coming out of college and that loneliness and not having the necessary skills to this point where, wait, it hits you. It's kind of like that light bulb moment. Yeah. And you're like, hey, this is where we need to go. So how does that, because I know you started the business. Was it your idea? You have, I believe, three co-founders. How does it come about where, because you guys
so a lot of that early stage was very organic. I think we all of us kind of felt like it was just this project and
not even a business.
No, we actually thought that we would then we were arguing about how many desks we would take ourselves to start our real business out
wow,
of this thing.
I love it.
Yeah. And but then something, you know, that moment where people were coming to these classes, I think sort of was an interesting thing because it was this additional revenue. It was really interesting. And then I actually can remember this one meeting we had in that classroom. And I think I had just gone away on a trip or something, came back and had prepared this sort of presentation and saying, the theory is that it's about return. It's about, this is an investment model. And if we can move ourselves from edutainment to investment, there's probably a really big opportunity. And how do we get there?
Right.
And I think that was sort of the sea change moment because we started to work on this our first long form course. We were very cautious. We were worried what happens if we tell people they can get jobs and then they can't.
Right, yeah.
We knew nothing about this. We didn't know how to build curriculum. We didn't know what a good teacher looked like. But we kind of just made it up. And so I remember that first time we marketed a course. It was our front end web development course. And we found two people who were like, sure, I'll teach that. And we got
no credential. You just no idea.
One of them was like a really badass hacker, and the right. other one was sort of more of a somewhat mainstream, like, you know, person who knew a little bit about
it. Was coding? Was that
it was coding?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And to our surprise, I think we decided 15 spots was a lot. Right? We didn't know what the right size of a
how much
class
did you
was.
Even charge, or how did you?
We
go
didn't
about
know.
Even?
I think we made it up. I think right. we said $3,000 right. or something like that, and we put it out and see who would. And we got 150 applications.
Wow.
And so we were like, okay, that's the next level. Okay, we have, there's energy here as well as the sort of the key next moment, right? And so again, we don't know, can we times that by 100? Can we times
right.
that by 1,000? We don't know. We have no idea. But okay, you're still on that journey. It's still working. That thesis of something that will provide real value will actually get people to pay out of their own pocket, which at the time was also very radical in the world of education because it was thought you couldn't really do anything in education without sort of regional accreditation. So
yeah.
you could get federal Pell grants and loans. And so this was a kind of outside the box idea. And that really became the business that we scaled all around the world. So we went from one classroom, and I talk about that times 100, we now have, I think, a little over 100, maybe 110, 120 classrooms around the world.
Amazing.
And of course, we got better at utilizing those classrooms. We have a whole business basically going to other people's classrooms in large companies as well. But that was really the moment that everything changed. And, you know, I think the thing I'm most proud of in that is that in some way, I really did build a business for the younger version of me or
yeah.
all the people out there who feel like that.
Exactly.
Who feel lost and lonely and are not sure where to go and are not sure they should go spend another 150 grand on graduate school.
Yeah.
Are miserable in their jobs but feel trapped there. Don't really know how to get to a place where they're happy in their work and their life. And I'm so proud of the fact that we can provide that for so many people. We have over 70,000 alumni of these three-month courses. We work with about half of the Fortune 500. And those people are just as lost and lonely in their jobs, too.
Even though they have a job,
doesn't mean that you're not lost and lonely.
There's a whole nother wave for you of, I'm sure, as it sounds like you're providing content to some of those big companies. So for you, really, at this point, you're going back to your learning experience of how miserable you were and how lost you were coming out of school and saying, this is the perfect thing for me, Jake, at 21 or 22. Mm-hmm. And it was the first class you put out there, the response you had was incredible.
Oh, yeah.
So you learn really from that first kind of misery, like, that was my business idea. And then it takes off.
Yeah, so you can see there's multitude of factors, right? It's never just one thing. I love people say, oh, I woke up in the middle of the night, I had this thing.
I jotted it down.
It's a great story. It goes into this narrative we love to have of the heroic entrepreneur.
Of course.
But, you know, now I know lots of entrepreneurs, and the reality is it's always this sort of triangulation between a personal passion point, an opportunity in the market, and an opportunity on the ground. And when you can triangulate those things is when magic has the potential to happen. Now, it sounds, I think when you repeated that back to me, that moment when we ran that first class and it worked, that sounds like, oh, great, then it was off to the races.
Right,
it
can't
and
be.
And it wasn't, we didn't know what was going to work. We tried a bunch of courses, some worked, some didn't. But I think that was at the moment, that was great because I have this theory that it's really the amount of experiments you're allowed to make. It really determines how successful you can be.
Yeah.
And so we, at that point, had the room. We had managed to raise a Series A from Maveron.
They were your first investor. And do you have to show, at that point, when you raised your first dollars, how many classes had you done? How big was the business?
Well, we had all this co-working revenue, and we were telling this education story. So I think Maveron deserves a lot of credit for taking a pretty big risk on something. You know, we probably had about $2 million of revenue that year. So it wasn't like we were... But again, it is very easy to take a space, sell people desks, and get revenue.
Yeah.
This is sort of the secret of the co-working business. And they took sort of this... It was really their own leap of faith that we were going to figure out something around this education idea that was going to be really interesting. So that's pretty much the story of how we did it. And then, of course, you know, you got to raise more capital, you got to scale. I knew nothing about how to run a company, all the challenges. And so we talk about that moment of that leap of faith, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. Well, there's like, what nobody tells you is there's about 50 of those leaps of faith you have to take along that journey if you're going to be successful.
Yeah, that's so true. It's not just, you know, we talked about this one obstacle, and on this show we like to focus on a big obstacle, but there are so many of those jumps. So just the story, because it does, like, you guys have become this massive company, you get sold for a massive amount of money, but on your way up, so we talked about that the first class, great, 150.
Yeah.
What were some of those kind of milestones and learning experiences that you then took to get to the point where you sell the business for $400+ million?
I mean, there's a bunch of them.
Right.
And some I'm still learning from, right? One I talk about sometimes is... We had gotten a little expansion happy, and there's always a point where you want to raise your next round at a higher valuation. You're reading about all these big valuations. You want to be part of that cool kids club. And so you start saying, okay, well, how are we going to grow? How are we going to grow faster?
Yeah.
And there was a moment where I said, well, screw it. Let's just go as many places as we can think of. And so I remember I got like... everybody on the team, basically, in this closet, in this room. And I said, guys, it was almost like a cabal, a secret. And I said, how big can we go? How many places could we go? And we started talking about, okay, we're going to open 10 new markets in the next couple quarters. And like, at the time, what we would do is just send someone literally with a suitcase and say, have fun, right?
Go open like Zimbabwe or wherever.
Not Zimbabwe, but probably the farthest flung at the time that we did was Berlin. And Berlin at the time was very hot. It had SoundCloud in it. People were talking about it as the sort of European startup hub. But we didn't look close enough to also know one of the reasons people love Berlin is because it's so cheap.
Right.
And one of the reasons it's so cheap is because really almost no one does anything in Berlin. It's a city that is like, the culture is so magical because you can literally afford to live on very little money, which means you can spend your whole day in cafes, smoking cigarettes, kind of like,
beer,
you know,
coffee,
like, and
latte.
And that was sort of the first one we ever went to where, you know, the curve didn't work. The growth curve didn't work. Nobody was interested. And it took us like a year to sort of extract ourselves from that situation.
Did you have to kind of at that point, you know, it sounds like a lot of the other places you were popping them up, it was working. At that point, do you have to go and dig a little deeper to realize which are the markets that are really
going to work? Yeah, but that's sort of the moment of growing up. And now, what's funny about this is I'd gone to business school, so I kind of had all these frameworks. Okay, we should probably be doing it like this. But what happens in that early startup world is you're going so fast and you're just trying to keep everything moving that a lot, you don't have time to even
evaluate that.
Use the tools that you know you should be using to do it. And so that was really sort of the wake-up call of like, okay, we need to actually be managing this. We need some systems around how we look at a market and whether or not it's a place we should be going and what order. We need to prioritize these things. We need to be thinking about this. And I think in some ways that's maybe the benefit of the second time entrepreneur is once you've sort of gone through that, you kind of have a much better feel for when you need to bring more sort of grown-up paradigms to what you're doing earlier in the process. You make less mistakes. You still make mistakes, but they're a little more calculated. So that was sort of a big growing up moment. I would say, you know, there were times, I mentioned a little bit, we have a big B2B business.
In fact,
you know,
which is going into companies and
helping them reskill and upskill
their
employees.
It's
not even really still content. We're still doing GA.
Right.
But it's really in the context of helping people reskill and upskill their existing workers.
Right.
As well as sometimes bringing in new workers that they have trouble finding on their own by training as a sort of tool to bring the people with the right skills in. And I remember the first client we ever had for that. This is a great moment, was GE.
Okay,
right?
You go right to
fish.
The top.
Well, they had come in, you know, Beth Comstock, who
yeah,
was
sure,
like this
CMO.
Really amazing person. And she was at the time the CMO of GE. And she came and she said, "We've been hearing a lot about how cool you guys are.
It's got to be a great feeling.
What can we do? Oh,
Beth
it's
Comstock
so fun.
Coming
yeah.
in and being like, it's real. How can we work together? So what happens?
And she's really great at that, right? And they wanted, I think, to like sponsor a classroom or do a hackathon. And I just had this instinct because I remember, and this is sort of another part of probably the entrepreneurial personality in me. I remember even being at business school and saying, "What's that building over there?" And they're like, "Oh, that's the executive education wing of business." Of the business school. And I was like, "Why is it nicer?" And they're like, "Because it makes more money." And I think I already sort of like lodged that in the back of my head. And so I said, "Well, maybe we don't want to do anything like a sponsorship or market. That's not really that interesting. But what if we could help your people become more sort of hip and startup-like by bringing some of the stuff we're teaching in this little classroom we have over to you guys?" And that became... And really credit to Matt Breimer, who's my one of my co-founders, who really like stewarded this. That became a little B2B business.
Sure.
Now, we had no idea what we were doing there. And I think we actually still have done work with GE since then. But that first thing was like a big discovery. And then, of course, the bad thing about it is we were learning on GE.
Right.
And we made every mistake in the book.
Your biggest.
And we didn't understand anything about what they needed or what they wanted or how to actually scope things properly and define success and work with a client in a way that's actually sustainable. And so that was probably the biggest deal we got for 2 years. Right.
Right.
But
you learned.
You learn and you saw it and it established a division of the company. And eventually it really was the thing that I think attracted Adecco towards this model because they have all the same clients around
the
world.
They're a human resource company, and I'm sure a lot of their clients were a lot of your clients that you were getting in with people like Beth Comstock and those big businesses. I'm sure that's what they saw. And how big a part of the General Assembly business was the enterprise business?
For a very long time, it was very small. In fact, we had board meetings where my board would say, "Why are you even doing this?"
Oh, wow. They were the opposite. They're like,
"Yeah, they
why
were
are
like, this is so small. Your consumer focusing on individuals is growing. It's such a great story. Why are you
scaling
it?"
Yeah.
And I think I just had this gut. I was like, "Well, look, if we're in the business of helping people get jobs and they're investing in us to get them jobs, it certainly makes sense to also be thinking about how to build really deep relationships with the employers that they want to get jobs from."
Exactly. It's like, hey, you got one over here, one over here. Let's put them in. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And that's really how I still see the market that we're in is that it's really a two-sided market, right? It's individuals and it's companies. And what we are trying to do is use learning, right? Use training, whatever you want, skills development, this educational model, not for its own sake, like a lot of universities, but really as a way to lubricate that market, right? To decrease the friction between those two parties and allow for more people to be sort of viable candidates for the employers and for the employers to have more viable candidates to choose from.
So it sounds like obviously it's going well. You're into something that is so meaningful, I mean, education to everyone on this planet. Where going out a few years from now or 5 years from now, is this sustainable? Is this where education is going? What do you think?
Well, I think first off, it's important to note that education isn't one thing.
Right.
And I think this is one of the other things that investors make the mistake, entrepreneurs make the mistake, is thinking of it, well, that's the biggest market in the world. It's actually not one big market. It's a bunch of markets that are all very sizable. I mean, graduate school in the US is like a $80 billion a year market or something, right? But that's not very different than K-12. It's very different than vocational training. It's very different than corporate training. It's very, right? And the more you look at it the same, you start to not sort of see the opportunities and the nuances and the value propositions of each of those things. A lot of people have asked me, why aren't you going into K-12 and doing classes for high school kids? I said, because that's totally different. High school kids don't know that they want a job yet.
Yeah, completely different when I think about that.
But you have to sort of look at it from different lenses to get that. So I do think, what I hope is that our model, which I think at this point has been relatively well established in the world of tech and tech jobs, it's still very, very small, right? And there's a lot of people. The real barrier to both that market getting bigger, but also to taking this model to other types of skills and other types of jobs and other types of audiences is really this question that I think is at the heart of most education innovation, which is who pays what, when, why, where, and how. And why that's so important is education, because it's such a big investment, the financing of it is the core lever, maybe the most important lever in the whole thing. And so one of the challenges that I see that I'm trying to work on right now is, how do we get more active employers? Because employers currently spend like $100 billion a year on talent acquisition.
It's amazing.
Another $100 billion on internal training and things like that. It's larger than the federal government subsidy of higher education as a whole. How could we maybe decrease some of those redundancies, but also create pathways so that maybe someone who's on track to be a medical assistant doesn't have $60,000 of debt when they leave?
Right. And that's a major storyline of what is happening today.
It's completely happening.
You can't dig yourself out of that hole.
But you know, the historical solution to that was, well, if government can be the balance sheet,
right,
then that's not a problem. What we're seeing is, no, it's still a problem because it's still debt. And our country is almost like, there's no other country in the world that expects everybody to spend their own money or indebt themselves to get this level of education. Now, in some ways, in other markets, like in European countries, a lot of them, it's just government paid. So it's done in a different way. It's better in that there's no debt. But I think there's another set of the problems, which is that there's still no accountability between the individual and the institution, or the employer in the institution. And I think that is sort of the other piece that you want to try to solve, is how do you make the accountabilities a little more direct and not have the government as this sort of third party kind of mucking it up with all this free money. And so I'm really, really focused on, how do I build models where employers can take that money they're already spending on talent acquisition and talent retention,
a lot,
and reallocate it towards things that actually work, do this other purpose of building talent pipelines, of increasing the overall level of skills in the ecosystem that they're trying to hire from. And in the process, how do we make it closer to free for the individual? We were one of the first schools to try income share agreements, ISAs, in the United States, like 5 years ago.
Can you just, for our listeners?
So ISA is a very hot topic today. The concept's been around forever. Australia's actually had it for decades, where you, instead of it being technically debt, it looks a little more like equity, where your school is paid for by a third party, but to pay it back, you're paying a percentage of your income as opposed to a fixed amount every month that keeps accumulating regardless of whether or not you're employed. And it makes sense. It's a little more aligned. I still believe that at some level, it's still debt. It's just debt with a different repayment mechanism. But it definitely is a first step along this line of aligning interests a little better. But now ISAs are a very hot topic, and in Silicon Valley, you know, there's one of our sort of copycat boot camps out in Silicon Valley who's just went out just with the ISA story, sort of, which is brilliant. It's the right thing to do but I still think it's a vague improvement. And we now have the largest ISA facility on the planet, I think, or at least in our space. And we see that our students really love it. They're embracing it. It's great. But I keep thinking about what's next, right? Because I'm really interested in the skills gap in allied healthcare. We have more healthcare jobs than we're going to be able to fill over the next
decade. There's so much opportunity. And it seems like...
What about all these advanced manufacturing jobs? There are jobs that we don't even know about yet. And the problem is this boot camp model really works for jobs, you know, that like it costs, let's call it $10,000 to $15,000 to learn it. And then your starting salary is, call it somewhere between $60,000 and $80,000 with a lot of growth afterwards. Yeah. That sort of ROI makes sense.
It makes sense for someone.
But what about someone who, where the first job's $45,000 a year? There's a lot of people in this world who that would be a ton of money and a really great job.
Yep.
And what they're looking for. How do we build a model that's more higher ROI for them as well? And that's where I think the employer becomes such an important part of it and why we spend so much time on that side of the equation.
So it sounds like, I mean, you've got your hands full. It's not like, hey, we sold this business. You're really going to be focused on these next steps. And it sounds like there's so many growth opportunities. I know we have only a little bit of time left, and it's been completely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I love the energy, man. You're like you're ready to attack the world, and you've done such great. I mean, that's got to be, you know, some people, they start businesses. I started an experiential agency, and other people start. You really started a business that's great. I did well. I sold it. But that's got to make you feel really good, because it's a business that's really changing people. It's transforming.
I think for me, when I started, I just wanted to be an entrepreneur, right? If you had told me, okay, you're going to be an entrepreneur making widgets, I probably would have been like, okay, thank God. At least I can pay my rent. But I think on that journey, I look at how much of these decisions are about something underlying of like, I really, as an entrepreneur, feel very passionate about creating real value for people, right? Not like shaving off a little thing here or, you know, like...
You're really doing something that is good for society. But it's good for people.
And I think it's always going to be part of my entrepreneurial career is how do we change people's lives? How do we do it? It's a pretty powerful way to go about the world. I will say that your business, like, I'm interested because I think one thing that I'm finding is that it's been so worthwhile, and it will be part of me forever, and this sort of legacy of sort of helping to create this category, you know, maybe creating this category, and hopefully leading towards all sorts of changes in all parts of the educational system. But there are days where I'm like, man, it is hard.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with people and their lives, you can't experiment as much. You have to take it really seriously. And that's great. It's really powerful. But there are days where I'm like, man, what's it like to have a business where your job is just to bring a little joy into the world? I think at some point I'd like to do that.
I sell a Super Bowl trip or you get to go backstage at a Madonna concert.
Yeah.
But the reward, I will tell you, from that, it's nice because my businesses have always been experiential events and it does bring happiness to people. But at the end of the day, you're bringing transformative changes to people. And I think we are in this experiential economy. And at the highest level of this experiential economy are these transformative experiences.
You're right. You're basically, the highest level experience is your entire life.
Yes. It's how can I change my entire life and wow in something that's lasting. And that's my education in, let's say, coding or whatever you have done. And that's going to carry on.
And look, I think when you aggregate entire lives, then you can really get into some interesting stuff. So I think one of the things I'm most proud of is the way that by creating access points, we're allowing people who've never thought they could have a tech career. We're allowing people from very underprivileged backgrounds, you know, through scholarships, programs with companies. And I mean, one of the stories we're telling companies is you say you care about diversity. Here's the path to do it. You don't have to wait 10 years for computer science departments and all these STEM initiatives to bear fruit.
Right.
You can do it right now.
I love that. And that's really true because a lot of companies, and obviously now in corporate America, it's about inclusivity, diversity. And this is an actual way you can make those changes right now.
That's right. It's in your control.
Yes. That's interesting. I hope there's a lot of companies doing it. You are a fascinating person. I can't wait to see what comes next and just keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for coming on, Jake.
Thanks, man. This was great.
Appreciate it.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuckman, that's RobertTuckman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuckman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.